All right, everybody, good morning. It's good to see you. It's good to be back together, back in Genesis. I'm a bit under the weather. I know. Hopefully my voice does okay. But I'm excited to be here with you. Shepherd's Conference we're at like the tail end, finish line for Shepherd's Conference. It's always a big time. How many here were helping out at Shepherd's Conference, volunteering at Shepherd's Conference? Wow. Yeah, that's great. Thanks so much for those that helped. That was really a special time. All right, let's open in a word of prayer, and then we're going to dive into Genesis 10 and 11 today. Father in heaven, Lord, we come before you. We're thankful for this opportunity to come together, to fellowship together, to study your word together. We pray, Lord, that you would help us to have better insight into your word. We pray, Lord, that you would help us to be faithful in our interpretation of the text. We're so thankful, Lord, for Shepherd's Conference and just the opportunity to see so many different pastors who are doing faithful work. We pray, Lord, that as they go back to churches all over the world, that you would bless those churches and strengthen those churches. And bless us as well today as we study your word. We're thankful, Lord, for Christ, for this time that you've given us. And we pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. So we are in Genesis 10 and 11. And if you remember, we were given some extra time after this. This was going to be the final session that we were going to have. But we were given some extra time after this as well. So we're going to move right, next week, we're going to move right into Abraham, the Abraham narrative. And we're going to be talking about Abraham a good amount today as well. And then the week after that, we are going to be in, we're speaking about Isaac and Jacob, and then Joseph after that. So I'm going to bring in a little bit of Egyptology that final week. For anybody who's a nerd like me and excited about hieroglyphics and that kind of a thing, okay? All right. I have a rock here. It's just all rocks are the same age. So I think it's kind of funny when people date rocks because you're like, well, it's a rock, so it's all the same age. Some people get really excited about archaeology. I'm one that kind of gets really excited about archaeology, and I've made some collections over the years. Through archaeology, so I'll explain this rock and where it came from, and we'll talk about that when we get towards the end of our time together. But today, we are in Genesis 10 and 11. Now, chapter 10, very important, the Table of Nations, and I decided it would be helpful for us to have a map up. Unfortunately, this is a map that's got a lot of detail on it, so it's probably not super easy to see and read. I'm using this as just on Logos, and Logos did a really good job for this map in particular, kind of mapping out the different Table of Nations. We're going to talk through some of this, and I'm happy to, for anyone who would like, to send it to you as well, if you just want a snapshot of it. I believe that there's also one in the MacArthur Study Bible as well. It doesn't give quite as much detail, but that can be helpful as well. Now, Table of Nations is very important for us because we had a decreation in the flood, and then we have, in a sense, like a second start. Okay, so Noah and his family giving us a second start. God preserves them through the flood. They come out on the other side of the flood. So in a sense, Noah is kind of like Adam, right? So he's the father of everyone that's alive today and has been alive since Noah is descended directly from Noah. Okay, so Noah is all of our great, 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 etc. grandfather. Now, after we make that separation, or after the nations begin to separate, the question is, how do we track or understand all of these different nations? And last week, there was a really good question. I think it was from Leo. Leo asked good questions. It was from Leo talking about the distinction between someone who has a name and then a city or even a nation like named after that person. So sometimes it gives a word and you're like, is that a person? Is that a city? Or is that a nation? Right? Or is that a group? And they will tend to blend together. We're going to see that in chapter 10 today. They start to blend together. Even when we had Cain, who created a city or made a city, built a city, and he named it after his son, Enoch. Cain had an Enoch. That's not the Enoch who went to heaven, but he had a son named Enoch. He built a city, and he named the city Enoch after his son. So I have an individual who has the name Enoch, and I have a city that has the name Enoch. And so there's sometimes some correlation between those things. We're going to see the same sort of thing happen in Genesis 10. So let's read through. We're going to take this according to the, I'm hoping that's going to come back up, according to the sons, okay, chapter 10, verse 1. Now these are the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. His sons were born to them, and sons were born to them after the flood. We're going to talk as well today about, or re-talk about, our chronology. So I have 1,000, according to Genesis 5, I have 1,656 years between Adam and the flood. Okay, so I have a period of 1,656 years from Adam to the flood. Okay, we're taking those years as just normal years. We're not taking it out of order. And the thing about Genesis 5 and the thing about Genesis 11 as well is that I have two genealogies that say this person is this old when he begets this person, and this person is this old when he begets this person. And so we're able to track through. Not all genealogies are like that. Some genealogies just say this person fathered this person who fathered this person who fathered this person. But there's very intentional timestamps that are put into these genealogies. And I would say that that's for the intention, that's certainly for the intention of us understanding how much time is between Adam and the flood, how much time is between the flood and Abraham's birth, how much time is between Abraham and Jacob going down into Egypt, how much time from Egypt to, how much time are they in Egypt, how much time from Egypt coming out of Egypt until Solomon builds the temple, and when did Solomon reign? Okay, that's how we're generally tracking the chronology that we see all the way back to the flood and all the way back to creation. Okay, so I have 1,656 years, according to Genesis 5, from Adam to the flood. So sons were born to Shem, Ham, and Japheth after the flood. This is something that is quite interesting to me to understand the age of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We're going to see in just a little bit that Shem, in chapter 11, verse 10, it traces the line through Shem and says, these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old. He became the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. Okay, so he's 100 years old, and he becomes the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. It's going to trace it through that line. Okay, that means that Noah was 500 years old, roughly, when he had Shem. Now, we're not sure if Shem, Ham, and Japheth are triplets. It refers to Ham as being the youngest. Okay, and we're not quite sure if Shem or Japheth is older. There's some ambiguity in the text. It depends how you translate chapter 10, verse 21. Okay, so, and to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, and the older brother of Japheth, there's some ambiguity in the text there. You can kind of translate it as Japheth, the oldest, or Shem, the oldest brother of Japheth, or the older brother of Japheth. Okay, so there's some ambiguity. Is Shem firstborn, or is Japheth firstborn? We're not quite sure. We do know that Ham certainly is the youngest. Okay, so I have Shem, who's 100 years old, at the point of the flood. 2 years later, or 2 years after the flood, they don't have Shem, Ham, and Japheth don't have any children going onto the ark. And I have Shem, who listed out, gives begets Arpakshad 2 years after the flood. So why is Noah 500 years old when he has Shem? Japheth would be born after Shem. I would probably argue that, Ham is born after Shem. I would probably argue that Japheth as well is born after Shem. Okay, so why is Noah 500 years old when he starts having kids? That's something in the text that's just not explained to us, right? 500 years old before he starts having children? I mean, that's like a bachelor, you know, that's playing Call of Duty in your basement for a long time before getting married, you know? That's a long, long time. So why is Noah 500 years old before he has Shem, Ham, and Japheth? It mentions Noah's wife, but it doesn't mention how old that she is. It doesn't mention really much at all about her, just that she's included on the ark. It doesn't give her name. Okay, so as a contrast, Noah's father is 182 when he has Noah. Okay, so if you look back at that Genesis 5 chronology, you see that people are having children when they're 100, 150, 180, 100, 200. I think the oldest one that's recorded is 200, and I guess, I believe it's 210 or 205. Okay, so why is Noah 500 years old when he has Shem, Ham, and Japheth? We're not quite sure why that's the case. But in any case, Lamech fathers Noah when he's 182. And then we now have generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, chapter 10, again, chapter 10 is a different kind of genealogy. Okay, it's not tracing time, it's tracing nations. Okay, it's tracing nations. So we're going to see how people spread out based on where they're coming from, who their father is, great-great-great-grandfather is, and then also how did they start building moving around in terms of nations, not individuals, but moving into families, groups of people, and then nations after that. So we start with the sons of Japheth, and we only have a few verses for the sons of Japheth. And again, Japheth, Ham, Shem, it kind of changes order sometime. We usually think in terms of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, but that's not necessarily their birth order, and it also changes, whenever they're mentioned. It can go back and forth and list them in different ways. In this case, Japheth starts out first. So the sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togarmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, Dodanim. From these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his tongue, according to their families, into their nations. Okay, there's a lot of description that's given about Japheth. And one of the only things that we have in terms of this table of nations is a name that's given. And we're assuming that someone gains a name. Let's say that Japheth, you know, has Magog. Okay, that's a familiar term for us in other places in the Old Testament, Gog and Magog. Okay, you guys you'll remember that from Ezekiel. So I have someone, a son of Japheth, who's called Magog. Well, that's the name of the son, but then after I have the name of the son, that son has his own family, nation, grow into something that's a nation. Right? And apparently keeping some sort of the same name as they go. So on this chart, hopefully you can see this okay. You'll see that the descendants of Japheth, those are in red, the descendants of Ham in green, and the descendants of Shem in blue. Don't separate it out necessarily in your mind only according to region. Okay, and there's the chart that I have up here. There's debate, right? So how do I know that Javan is going to turn into the Greeks? How do I know that? How do I know that's the case? Okay, each one of these names, you would have to do its own study, right? Is it mentioned elsewhere? Is it mentioned in other languages? Is it mentioned in other histories? There's a whole lot of work that goes into trying to trace down each of these names. Some of them we know a lot about. Some we know very, very little about. Okay, so the descendants of Japheth, you can see that they're moving up into what would be modern-day Turkey. Okay, and you would have modern-day Turkey and then also moving over towards Greece. Okay, so up in the far north here. But again, don't think of it only as Shem is those that are in the Middle East and those that move east. And Japheth is all the European people, and Ham is those that are in Africa. That's not the case, okay? It doesn't divide up quite like that. There's a general movement of those who are descended from Ham. There's a general movement of them going south and into Africa, but that's, again, that's not exactly always the case. You have a general movement of Japheth and the line of Japheth going up north, but then also notice the emphasis that they have in the Mediterranean. Okay, so they are, I like to think of Japheth as the people that were on the coast, and they're like, why do we go on the land? Let's build a boat, and let's go out and check out what's out in the ocean. Okay, you guys know my fear of sharks, okay? So we'll leave it at that. Okay, so some of these names will not sound as familiar, but some names are much more familiar. Javan, as an example, Yavan is just the Hebrew word for Greek. Okay, so we use the term Greek or Greeks. You don't see Greek coming up in this list, but Yavan is the Hebrew term used for the Greeks. Okay, so Javan, as an individual, grows into a nation generally in reference to the Greeks. Okay, and it doesn't always just divide out very neatly, but generally in reference to the Greeks. You'll notice also similarities between the table of nations that we have and what we see also in the New Testament. So today, the political landscape has changed a great deal. So we think in terms of even Ottoman Empire, Turkey, up in that area in the north. Okay, so we think in those terms today, but when you have empires that rise and empires that change a landscape and empires that change borders and boundaries, then everything just gets mixed up. It can be very difficult to trace down those nations. But take a look at some of these names. You'll be reminded of them even from terms in the New Testament. An example would be something like Rodanim. We all know the Isle of Rhodes, okay? So you see similarities. You see some things that pop out even over the course of several thousand years that is similar. Magog would be familiar to us. Gomer is familiar to us, but not because of the nation. Okay, that's Hosea and Gomer. That's different. Okay, so don't be thrown off by that. Ashkenaz, maybe familiar as well. There's a group of the Jews who are Ashkenazi Jews. You have Sephardic Ashkenazi, different groups of Jews coming from different places. Okay, so we have similar terms. Madai would be related to like the Medes and the Persians. Okay, so we'll see that coming up later on. Aram, that we'll see from the descendants of Shem. Aram would turn into Damascus. Damascus being a central capital city. Aram Damascus, you might even remember that being a particular term. So Syria, okay, the Syrians becomes a very powerful empire later on. Kittim and the Hittites. Mitzrayim, we'll see descendants of Ham in just a second. Mitzrayim would be Egypt. Okay, that's just the Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim. It's from Matsur, meaning a stronghold. Okay, so Mitzrayim. Some really, really interesting names that we see. Havilah. Havilah coming from the descendants of Ham. When was the last time that Havilah was mentioned, the name or the term Havilah? Who remembers when the last time Havilah was mentioned before Genesis 10? Havilah, talking about the rivers that come out of Eden. And it says it goes out to Havilah. And it talks about the gold of that land is good. Okay, so it gives us really interesting description in the creation in Genesis 2. And it talks about four rivers that come out of Eden. They go through, or the one river goes through the garden. And then after the garden, it separates into four separate rivers. And those four rivers, it gives description about where they go. And one of the things that it talks about is that it is, one flows around the land of Havilah. And it says the gold there is good. You're like, that's great. How do I know where it is? I'd love to go digging there. Notice, though, the debate on Havilah. So Havilah here, it's all the way down in the south. The piano's in the way, so sorry about that. Havilah is all the way down in the south here. Okay, what's right next to Havilah? Ophir. There's a particular term called the gold of Ophir. So it relates, and it's the argument would be that Havilah and Ophir, even though one is coming from Ham, one is coming from Shem, there's something related to gold between those two. So if you're a treasure hunter, I might be going right there, okay? In any case, also, you'll have a term that's used before the flood, and then it can be reused after the flood. That's where we get some overlap and some difficulty, because just because one person is named this doesn't mean that it correlates to somewhere else that it's used. Okay, so Havilah being used in Genesis 10 doesn't necessarily mean that it actually relates to Havilah from before. Okay, I had an Enoch that was in the line of Cain. I had an Enoch that was in the line of Seth. Two different people, two whole different outcomes. Okay, there's can be same names, but different ideas, different outcomes. Okay, so generally we have we have the sons of Japheth who are going north into what Paul in his missionary journeys would later encounter as Asia Minor, okay, and then moving to the west as well. Okay, islands, eventually moving into what we would think of as Europe today. There's a mention of Tarshish as well, and there's a debate on Tarshish because, remember, Jonah went down to get a ship to go to Tarshish, and the idea is that he wanted to get as far away as he possibly could, and there is a port, a very important city, a port city called Tarshish, in southern Spain, what would be Spain today. So the idea is that he wanted to go all the way over there. Well, how do I have this huge gap, right? I have Tiras and Javan and Rodanim and Elisha, and it all seems to be kind of around the same area. And then I've got Tarshish, like, you know, 1,500 miles away. Well, is that right? Is that correct? Is it a different Tarshish, okay, or is it the same? Should we understand them as being the same as mentioned here? Okay, so that's the sons of Javan, right? So you have the sons of Japheth listed, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras, and then specifies the sons of Gomer in verse 3, and then it specifies the sons of Javan in verse 4, okay? But it doesn't give further elaboration on the other sons. It just says, let me talk about the grandsons that Japheth had only in relation to Gomer and Javan, okay, because they spread out and apparently became more important, more populous, let's just say. Okay, and then from these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his tongue. Now, that's really interesting because it says each one according to his tongue and to his language. Well, we haven't had Babel yet. Right? If we haven't had Babel yet, then how can I have each one having their own particular language? Okay, so we have to be, we're going to talk about that when we get into chapter 11. My argument is that chapter 11, Tower of Babel, is going to, it's a story that is before the Table of Nations. Okay, so you have the Table of Nations as like this overarching explanation. This is how the nations all spread out. But I have the Tower of Babel. I have one people group in the Tower of Babel. They're all moving one direction. God changes their languages, and then they spread out after that. Okay, so I'm going to make the argument that chapter 11 actually is chronologically before this chapter 10. You'll see where you'll have an overarching, especially like a chapter 10 like this, which is a very overarching statement, kind of giving the landscape of things, and then you'll have something that goes back and gives further definition or further clarification. Okay, so let's move on to the sons of Ham. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan, and we've already encountered Canaan, right, or Canaan, in chapter 9. Canaan is the one who's cursed. Ham is not cursed, okay? Ham does wrong against his father, but Ham is not cursed himself, okay? Canaan is cursed, and we'll see that later on in the next several weeks as we go through the rest of Genesis. Cush, though, is going to be south of Egypt, okay? Southern portion of Egypt. The Cushites is a group that we're going to see in the Old Testament several different times. Mitzrayim relating to Egypt, okay? Put as well, we believe, to be a large people group in Africa. The sons of Cush were Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Rama and Sabtika. The sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. These are great names. My wife and I, we have two daughters, okay? We have excellent daughter names. We have no great boy names, okay? No great boy names. So when we found out that we were having a second daughter, we're like, we're good, okay? We have no boy names. And so periodically I'll throw out some different names to my wife. Some great boy names, biblical names, right? Biblical boy names. And she's not with me on that. Okay, Sabtika, Sheba, Dedan. I make that joke because Nimrod is up next, okay? Do not name your son Nimrod. If you did, it is what it is, okay? But verse 8, now Cush was the father of Nimrod. And we get, it's in a sense, it's like when we have Enoch, right? You have like one sentence. So you have this whole list of people, like this person gave birth to this person, this person, this person. And then there was Enoch. And oh, by the way, Enoch just wasn't because he was gone. And then it moves on right after that. And you're like, can I get some more explanation about that? Can I get some further understanding about it? This happens a few different times in our chapter 10. Nimrod is one of those. It says he began to be a mighty one on the earth. And it says he was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. You're like, great, that's super. I'm not like really a huge hunter. Good. I'm glad that you were able to kill animals and that's great. I grew up hunting. Why is that important? Why is that necessary to describe him as a mighty hunter? The other instance that we have is going to be Peleg in verse 25, chapter 10, verse 25. Now two sons were born to Eber. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. You say, divided in what way? You got to tell me more about how it was divided. Are we talking about divided by nation? Are we talking about divided geographically? Are we talking about there's even an argument for irrigation, right? The earth was divided, like it began to be irrigated, because the word there can mean to like cut something into the earth for irrigation. There's so many different arguments about what it means the earth was divided. So in chapter 10, we have these instances where it's like, here's one sentence about this person or two sentences about this person that just moves right on after that. So how can we know who Nimrod is? Why is he important? And why does it go off on this little excursus for Nimrod? Nimrod's the son of Cush. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. That term mighty one is Gibor. Gibor, well, you remember Giborim back in chapter 6, okay? It's term Giborim. It's a very general term, though. It just means a mighty one, okay? It can mean a warrior or just Gibor, Gavar, just means to be strong, okay? So he began to be a mighty one. He's standing out in some way in terms of power. And then verse 9 says, he was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Why the repetition? What do you mean? Why is that important? Okay, verse 9 is tricky. Let me give you my understanding of it. So mighty hunter there is Gibor Tzaid. Gibor Tzaid. Tzaid just means hunting. And it almost always exclusively means hunting an animal. Gibor is just a mighty warrior. Okay, so it says that he was a mighty hunter. So that translation is dead on. Okay, but we don't gain a lot more insight into it. The translation is exactly right. He was a mighty hunter. You say, well, why mention that he's a mighty hunter? And then in addition to that, he's a mighty hunter before Yahweh. You say, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Okay, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing that he's a mighty hunter before Yahweh? And then therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. It says, who's saying this? And why is this a necessary statement? Okay, my argument for understanding this particular verse, when it says that it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh, this is the people who have created, and people in general, people of the earth, who have created a phrase around an individual, okay? They've created let's just say that Nimrod is the first influencer, okay? I'm speaking to my Gen Z brothers and sisters in Christ, okay? He's the first influencer. He's the first one who has such great influence that they're creating a statement or a saying based on what he's accomplished, what he's done. It says he's a mighty hunter before Yahweh. The before Yahweh there, I would take as being negative, but only because of who Nimrod is and what he does, okay, which I'll see a little bit later. So you can take before Yahweh as being either positive or negative, and it says that he's a mighty hunter. Dr. Barrick, whom I had in seminary, excellent, one of my favorite professors of all time, Dr. Barrick made the argument that when it says he's a mighty hunter, it means that he's hunting people. He's a slave trader. Okay, that's possible within the text, but it's not required of the text. Okay, I don't view Nimrod as being a good character. This is not a good guy, but in any case, he's a mighty one. And it talks about his kingdom. Nimrod, the name Nimrod, you can see this even in the MacArthur Study Bible. The name Nimrod means a rebel. Okay, so he's named rebel, the rebellious one. And this rebellious one, verse 10, it says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. We're going to see Shinar come up in chapter 10. They all journeyed east to a plain in the valley of Shinar, and there they wanted to build the Tower of Babel. Okay, so it pre-mentions Shinar here. It says that Nimrod began building not a city. Cain built a city, right, and named it after his son. Nimrod builds a city, builds a city, builds a city, builds an empire. Okay, he is an empire builder. Different than what we've seen before. Not only an empire builder, but you'll recognize these names. Babel, right? Mentions it first. Babylon. Okay, he's the one who builds Babel that we're going to see as well in 10. Okay, if he's building Babel, then he is the de facto leader of what happens in chapter 11. Okay, so Nimrod is the one who's governing and happening what's going on with the Tower of Babel. Okay, he builds Erech and Akkad. If you remember the Akkadians as a particular group of people, the Babylonians, Okay, Calneh, all of these very important cities. Verse 11, it says, from that land he went out to Assyria, and he built Nineveh. Nineveh is rebuilt and greatly extended later on by Sennacherib. Okay, so during Sennacherib's reign, the Assyrian, much later. But in any case, Nimrod builds the beginning of Nineveh. Rehoboth Ir and Calah. And Resen, between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Okay, so it gives these verses, this description of Nimrod. We see Nimrod, his name means rebel. He's a mighty hunter before the Lord. There's ambiguity on how to understand the meaning of that. But he's building empire. And he would be the leader of those at the Tower of Babel. It moves on, verse 13, Mitzrayim was the father of Ludim, Ananim, Lehabim, Naphtuhim, Pathrushim, Kasluhim, from whom came the Philistines and Kaphtorim. Okay, so it's giving you insight. Think of the first time this is read. Okay, Moses is reading this to the people, and they say, oh, the Philistines, I know who those are. We're about to go fight them. And so it's giving description of some different groups, of course, that Israel would have known right before they go into the promised land. Okay, verse 15, Canaan was the father of Sidon. Sidon is a familiar term for us. King of Sidon, right, who interacts with Solomon in building the temple. His firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite, and afterward the families of the Canaanite were scattered. So it lists very particular groups, and it calls them ites. Ites, 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 and those are groups, that's not an individual. It's saying from one individual or from a group of individuals, you have a larger group that's coming. Now we're growing into tribes, we're growing into different groups, nations, and the Canaanites is the overarching term for those nations in the area, okay, in the region. So I have Hivites, Arkites, Sinites, Arvadites, Zemarites, etc. as you go through. Notice, I'll bring this out because of my argument in Genesis 6. Notice that in this group, you do not have mentioned Nephilim. You do not have mentioned those that are coming from the Nephilim, Giborim specifically, in terms of those that are coming from the Nephilim. And you don't have those groups that are mentioned. When the Israelites go into Canaan, they're going to interact with some of those. Okay, and they're going to say, we came across giants in the land, and it's going to give description. Sihon or Og, king of Bashan, is in that category, but it's not listing those as coming from Noah and his family. That would be my argument for the and afterward, right? So the Genesis 6, 1 through 4 happens before the flood, but then after as well. Okay, so the border of the Canaanite extended from Sidon as you go towards Gerar, as far as Gaza, as you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and Adma and Zeboim, as far as Lasha. These are the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their tongues, by their lands, by their nations. So Sodom and Gomorrah even is mentioned. Yeah. They don't have a lineage from Noah, right? So they're wiped out. What happens before the flood, the Nephilim, the lineage, the corruption, right, within genealogies is wiped out in the flood. So you have Noah and his family who are making or producing the nations of the earth. But then I also have instances of these giants and things that come after the flood as well, but they're not listed as being included within the genealogy. It's something that happens, I would argue, after. Leo? Yeah. Yeah.
They are to be cursed.
Yeah.
How connected is this curse?
Right.
Coming after when God instructed specifically to cleanse all these Ammonites and all
Right. So that, it's a very good question. It's a very good question because you have the curse upon Canaan. And Canaan, the curse in particular, is that he's going to be a servant of servants, right? So it's cursing in a particular way. He's going to be subservient to his brothers. He's going to be subservient to those descended from Shem, those descended from Japheth. But it's Canaan in particular. It's not all of Ham. It's Canaan in particular. But as you have these groups, let's say the, you know, Jebusite, right? Amorite. Jebusite is a really good example because you have Jebusites that are talked about later on. They're the ones who are controlling Jerusalem in the time of David. So David takes Jerusalem back from the Jebusites. But who is a Jebusite? Melchizedek is a Jebusite. Okay, so I have good people within these different categories. By the time we get to Israel coming up out of Egypt, so I have from Noah until the birth of Abraham is 292 years. From Abraham to going down into Egypt is 290 years. And then 430 years in Egypt. So I have several, not quite 1,000 years, between the time that these nations are starting to be formed and going out and the Israelites who are coming coming into Canaan. So we have a long period of time in which the Canaanites are living in the land. I have Melchizedek, who's king of righteousness, who is a Yahweh worshiper, who's a priest of Yahweh, but I have a period of time in which these people become worse and worse and worse and worse, such by the time that Israel is coming into the land, God's saying they are completely corrupt. They're like those who were before the flood. Every intention of their heart is only evil all the time. At that point, God is saying, wipe them out. Yeah.
Is it only that line that then there were the giants in, so the Nephilim, it's not?
Yeah, they're not mentioned elsewhere. They're not mentioned elsewhere. And it's particularly in regards to the Canaanites specifically. So it's hard to know because the Bible's not trying to be exhaustive on what that was, but it we're only looking at where it mentions those instances. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Sodom and Gomorrah, right? So you have these instances as we go through the rest of Genesis and even into Exodus, all the way into Joshua, let's say. You have these instances where there is a wiping out of a people. Okay? We had that at the flood. But God, after the flood, says, I will never again wipe everybody out on the face of the earth. But remember, we talked last week. Well, if he's not going to wipe everybody out, but everyone's heart is still evil, then shouldn't I just expect the same result? Right? Shouldn't I expect the same result that people are going to be wicked and just increase to wickedness as far as they can possibly run? Yes. So God puts stipulations in place, and God says, all right, here's a stipulation. If you murder somebody, you ought to be killed. You ought to be put to death. He puts particular stipulations in place to hold and restrain people back from that evil, because God is saying, I'm working with you, I'm working with the creation for a particular amount of time. I'm not just going to, every 1,000 years, wipe everybody out and start over again, and wipe them out and start over again. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to work with everybody for a particular amount of time. So by the time we get to Genesis 10 and 11, in your mind, you should be thinking, is there another flood coming? So what way is God going to bring a redemption into the world? Right? Because I now have Tower of Babel in 10, and I have people scattered all over the earth. And you're like, okay, that's helpful because it's holding them back. It's restraining them. But it's just extending the time, isn't it? I mean, we're just, okay, maybe it extends it for another 500 years before they figure out how to develop iPhones and chat with each other and figure out what's going on in the world. Like, in what way or how is it going to restrain? But the better question is, in what way is redemption going to come through? That's why we have to have Abraham in 12 or Abram in 12 right after 11, because it's God saying, oh, I'm going to particularly work with you. So the promise in chapter 12, I'm getting ahead of myself, but the promise in chapter 12, I will bless those who bless you. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. We've only had curse to this point. God blessed and said, it is good. Creation is good. It's all good. Man sinned, and it's, you're cursed, you're cursed, you're cursed. I'm going to curse the world. I'm going to curse with a flood. The ground is cursed. Everybody's cursed now. And you say, what hope is there? How are we going to overcome that? The heart problem is still there. So that promise to Abraham, in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. That is monumental. That's huge. That's the switch that we have between chapter 11 and 12, right? So,
is that considered a covenant?
It's the promise. It's the promise of the covenant. In 15, the covenant is actually made. Genesis 15, yeah. All right, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me backtrack for a second here. So 10:20, these are the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their tongues, by their lands, by their nations. Also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber. Notice how it describes Shem. It's a really interesting way to describe Shem, because Eber is not really talked about that much. Not a lot is said about Eber. But it says, to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber. Eber is a son of Shem, or descended from Shem, right? And so it's weird to describe Shem as the one who's the father of the children of Eber, right? It's like defining your grandfather by his son, okay? Your father. It's a weird way to put it. So a great deal of emphasis is placed upon Eber, but nothing is described of Eber. We think that the word Hebrew, okay, the word Hebrew is coming from Eber, which is really interesting because Eber has more descendants than just the Hebrews. Okay, so the fighting, well, let me get to that in a second. Okay, so the father of all the children of Eber and the older brother of Japheth. Again, there's a question, is Shem the oldest or is Japheth the oldest? Okay, so the sons of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arpachshad and Lud and Aram. Elam, you may remember the Elamites. Elamites are all the way towards what would be the Persian Gulf. Okay, so Elam on the Persian Gulf. Elamites and the Assyrians, my mind is blanking. The Elamites and the Assyrians are avid enemies. They're always trying to kill each other. It's interesting because they're descended from the same person. But in any case, you have the Assyrians and the Elamites who are descended from Shem, but you have Nimrod who builds Babel, Babylonians, okay? So you can already see that there's a interesting discrepancy between Elamites, Assyrians coming from the same group, and Babylonians or Babel coming from elsewhere. But they're mixing together. So there's always a question that I get from students. Well, you have Babylon in Daniel, who's considered like the first great kingdom. You say, well, what about the Assyrians? Weren't they like the first great kingdom? Well, they're together, but it's like two brothers that are fighting against each other, but the Babylonians are descended from different than the Assyrians are. In any case, the sons of Shem, Elam, Asher, Pakshad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz. That's a very important reference for me because I love the book of Job, and Job is from the land of Uz. Okay, not the land of Oz, but the land of Uz. So Aram were Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. Aram, of course, relating to Syria. Arpachshad was the father of Shelah. Shelah, the father of Eber. So Eber is descended from Shem. But then it gives description. He had two sons. Two sons of Eber were born. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. Palag, Peleg, just means division, separation. But that can be division of all kinds. In what way? Like political division, geographic division? It's not really mentioned. I usually take it as being political division, like the Tower of Babel, possibly, because of what's about to come. But Lot's make an argument that in his days, like, the earth separates, changes. I now have movement of the plates. So Peleg, and then his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan was the father of Almodad and Shelef and Chazarmavet and Jera, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, Jobab. Jobab, that's a good one. I proposed that a while to my wife, Jobab, but still didn't appreciate it. All these were the sons of Joktan. Joktan has a whole host of sons that move into what would be today like Saudi Arabia. Okay? So he has a whole host of sons that move and form groups, tribes in that area. Okay? But what's interesting is that all of the sons of Joktan and Peleg are both from Eber. So we get the word Hebrew from Eber. Okay, but according to the Bible, Eber is the father of both Eber, Jews, those are coming from and coming, you know, eventually Abraham is going to come on the scene. Okay, but also those that would be in Saudi Arabia. Okay, so there's relationship amongst everybody. But it's interesting to note that. Leo, you've got a good question. I can see it on your face. You've got a good one. Yeah.
Be able to pinpoint this is what happened while, you know, this was happening in the Bible.
Yeah.
In these, you know, more historical early, what references we can find?
Yeah, right.
Because I already see a couple of points of different nations would have different their their stories.
Yeah. Histories.
Ancestral folkloric history.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of the names are already mentioned.
Yeah.
So how do we connect those?
Right,
and
right.
And then second follow-up question for people that went down to the desert. So
yeah.
In the Bible, at a later point, he talks about, there was a section, he talks about the people, the tribal people.
That, yeah.
That lived under the tent.
Right.
And then so, these people were living, they were tribal living in tents.
Yeah.
And up until today, still we see like a lot of tribes in
right.
Israel and around it. This
right.
is how they live, the Bedouins. So what is...
Yeah. Time, I don't want to discount the element of time. This is one thing that I wanted to point out today. If it's helpful in terms of the world chronology, okay, kind of break it into, let's say, three sections, okay, of 2,000 years each, okay, is my general, like, this is helpful, okay? You have from the time of Adam until the time of the flood, 1,656 years, okay? That is a world unto itself. It's something where we're getting 11, not even, you know, we're getting 9 chapters, okay, of that world, and not a whole lot else, not a whole lot of other description about it. Time is going to slow down once we hit Abraham, and then it's going to slow down even more and more and more until we're dealing in like a period of a couple of years in Joseph's life, okay, and then it'll speed up again when we get to Exodus, and then it'll slow down again as we move into the conquest, and it'll speed up and slow down, but there is not so much time that is covered as in Genesis 1 through 9, let's say, okay, from Adam all the way to the flood. A huge amount of time that's covered in that. Think about trying to encompass the scope of history from now until, let's say, let's go back to the Council of Nicaea, okay? Council of Nicaea is in 325 AD. Like, what all happened between that Council of Nicaea and today? Like, how many books, how many history books have been written dealing with the movement of peoples, the change of borders, wars that have happened, just massive change that has occurred, technological change, all sorts of things that have happened. So you think, I have 1,656 years from Adam all the way until the flood. Like, what was that world like? So I kind of view that as my first, let's say, 2,000 years, okay? First period that I have. My next period is from Abraham, okay? Which I've got a gap, of course, between the flood and Abraham, but not a lot of gap. There's a couple of hundred years only between the flood and Abraham. Think about a worldwide flood having happened in the, let's say, early 1800s for us, okay, in terms of like referencing the movement of time. Okay, a worldwide flood that killed everyone except for some guy and his family on an ark in the early 1800s. Okay, that's the period that Abraham's living in. We're a couple of hundred years removed from the flood. Okay, Abraham lives for quite a lengthy period of time, but you have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and I have this huge amount of information that's given from Abraham all the way through until, let's say, the coming of Christ, okay? That could be another period of 2,000 years. Abraham is born, we think, about 2150 BC, something like that, okay? So we have this period of time, 2,000 years, we have so much more history, and we're able to track people better. But the earlier you go back, the harder it is to track and say, all right, these people with this name did this and moved here, because it's not monolithic, right? It's Terra moved, right, from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran, right? So how much movement is there amongst the peoples? How much overlap and changing and wars that take place, and these people are wiped out and these people grow to be extensive, and how much of that occurs? It's so difficult to track those things. But if that's helpful for you, I mean, think through those periods in a couple of thousand years. So we have from Christ until now, 2,000 years. We have from Abraham to Christ, about 2,000 years. We have from Adam to Abraham, about 2,000 years. Okay, and that first segment, we know the very least about. Very, very minimal amounts that we have understanding of that. It's hard for us to grasp 1,000 years. It's hard for us to grasp 200 years. So Leo. Right.
And then whatever
right.
he passed on. And that's
yeah.
in the Jewish tradition, they always follow the
right.
world in addition to the...
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And the further that you get outside, you have Noah and the tracing of this line, right? Noah, Shem, Eber, Abraham, or Terah, Abraham. Like, you have this tracing of the line. The more tangential that you get outside of that, the more it's like, it's just hard to trace. It's hard to trace things down. So like Javan, we know Hebrew word Javan for Greeks, but what was Javan like? Is he actually like the Greeks only? What does that look like? Okay. All right. It's a good time to pass around my rock if you would like. Okay. actually, let me talk about Abraham for a second. I'm going to skip for a second. Let's go to chapter 11, verse 10. Okay, we're going to skip Tower of Babel. We talked about this genealogy in with Shem beforehand as well, so I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on it. But these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old. He became the father of Arpakshad 2 years after the flood. Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arpakshad. He had became the father of other sons and daughters. See that other sons and daughters? They're mentioned in 10, right? So we know how many children that he had because it's listed. These are all of the children that he has in chapter 10 because the Table of Nations wants to account for everybody who's coming from these three. Okay, but here, this is a different genealogy, and it's saying, I want to trace one line through all these people, one line, and I want to trace it right down to Abraham. So it just says he has other sons and daughters. Arpakshad lived 35 years. He became the father of Shelah. Arpakshad lived 403 years after he became the father of Shelah, became the father of other sons and daughters. Notice the descending life links. Shelah, 30 years, became the father of Eber. Sheba lived 403 years after he became the father of Eber. Eber lived 34 years. Eber lived 430 years after he became the father of Peleg. Peleg lived 30 years, became the father of Reu. Reu lived 32 years, became the father of Serug. Serug lived 30 years, became the father of Nahor, verse 22. Nahor lived 29 years, became the father of Terah. And Terah, in verse 26, Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This will go back to Leo's point about the names and what exactly is going on with names and cities. I want you to notice some important things in verse 27 through the end of chapter 11. These are the generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran became the father of Lot. We're going to see, of course, later on. Haran died in the presence of Terah, his father, in the land of his birth, in Ur of the Chaldeans. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Doesn't mention their relationship. Later on, we learn that they're at least half brother or sister, or full brother or sister. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran. So he takes a niece for his wife. Okay, a little weird. The daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, the father of Iscah. And Sarai was barren. She had no children. Why is it important to mention Milcah? Because Genesis 24:15 is Abram saying, go back to his servant, go back and find a wife for my son, for Isaac. Okay, and Rebekah is the daughter of Milcah. You can take a look at Genesis 24:15 for that. But then, verse 31, it says, Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldees. Who's left behind? Nahor. Right, Haran dies, but Nahor is left behind in Ur of the Chaldees. Apparently doesn't want to go. They went out together from Ur of the Chaldees in order to go to the land of Canaan. So it's Terah's intention, I want to go to the land of Canaan. I'm going to bring along Abram and bring all these, you know, whoever's going to go with me. I'm going to go to the land of Canaan. Why is it that he, Terah, wants to go to the land of Canaan? When we have Yahweh in chapter 12 speaking to Abram, chapter 12, verse 1, Yahweh said to Abram, go forth from your land, from your kin, from your father's house, to the land which I will show you. Okay, so it's Yahweh calling Abram, saying, you go out. But I have Terah who is going out. Okay, so I like to think that it's Abram convincing his father Terah, saying, I've heard from the Lord, we need to go. Okay, kind of like those leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, if you will. Let's go. Abram convinces Terah his father, and Terah is convinced, takes Abram, takes Sarai, and takes Lot, the son of Haran. Haran died in Ur already. Nahor stays behind. And it says, they came as far as Haran and settled there. And you say, isn't Haran the name of his son? So what's this new place Haran called? Okay, and there's ambiguity. It's a question. Did this place already exist? Or we're still quite early in terms of history here. Is Terah going to a place and stopping and saying, I don't want to go any further, Abram. I'm not going to continue on here. And so he builds a place for himself and he names it after his dead son. Okay, as a memorial of some kind. Okay, but he goes as far as Haran. In fact, I'll let me switch to. Okay, we'll talk more about this in terms of Abraham next time. Okay, but there's a question: does he come from Ur of the Chaldees here? Okay, down in the south, right next to Sumer, even farther away than Babylon, or Ur of the Chaldees could also be up north. Okay, there's some debate which one that it is. In any case, they go to Haran. Okay, and you can see Haran farther up. He's made it, let's say, halfway or so to the promised land. And Terah says, no, I don't want to go anymore. I'm not going to go any further. So he stops in Haran. And then Terah dies in Haran. Okay, so he dies in Haran. Now I have the whole scene set up. I've got Abram, who's going to go down and to continue the journey, go down. I've got Lot, and I have Abram, his wife, Sarai. Okay, so that's going to set up the rest of the story. Now I'll pass around my rock, okay, if you're interested. Some people are like, it's a rock. Like, what are you doing? Okay, but I really like archaeology. This rock is from the wall of Haran, and from that period, from the time. Okay, after Haran is built up. So they're making use of rocks. When we get to the description of Shinar, so they don't have rocks, they're going to use bricks. Okay, they're going to bake bricks and make bricks because they don't have abundant rocks available for their building. Okay, very, very rarely in this area would you be using wood to build a structure. Okay, in certain places, let's say a roof beam, something like that. But wood, we use wood consistently. In our building, you're not going to see that the same. Okay, so in Shinar, it's bricks because they don't have rocks that are being dug up. In Haran, you have more rocks readily available. Chisel it out, build it up. All right, now let's go to Tower of Babel 11:1. So it says, now the whole earth had the same language and the same words. That's where I think it's going back, saying I've talked about the nations, I've talked about the spread of the nations and kind of where different ones are going, but now I'm going to go back and talk about a particular story. Yeah. Yep, right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, so there's an Ur. There's a debate as to, there's two options from where it says Abram came from Ur of the Chaldeans. It could be either. This is the most famous to say Ur of the Chaldeans from here. But there's an option as well as coming from the north, Urartu and the Zagros Mountains, okay, Ur of the Chaldeans. So we're not sure exactly which one. I take this, right, from Sumer, that he's coming from this Ur in particular, and that he's traveling through. This Ur is famous for Nana, great name as well, the goddess, the moon goddess. Okay, and they had a very important structure that they built for the moon goddess in Ur. We'll talk about that in relationship to our tower. But we know that they came to Haran, so we know Haran here, which is where that rock is from the wall. Okay, so we know Haran, but there's a question of which Ur was it that he came from originally.
And it actually makes me think that it's the one up north, because in chapter 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go forth from your land, from your kin, and from your father's house.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's telling him to leave your father. Well, at least to me, it would have to be at that point.
Yeah.
At least in my head, for him to leave his father, because his father didn't go further.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. So when we get to 12, it's saying, go from your father's house, right? But the only people in Haran are Terah, Abram and Sarai and Lot, right? Because Nahor was left behind in Ur. And so in chapter 12, when it says, go forth from your father's house, if he's leaving from Haran to do this, his father's dead and he's taking everybody with him. So what do you mean, go forth from your father's house? So I think chapter 12, when it says, pick up, go from your father's house, that's Yahweh speaking to Abram in Ur of the Chaldeans, not in Haran. It's a very good point. So now the whole earth had the same language and the same words. We'll go through Tower of Babel. I want you to hear the irony. This is, it's a funny story. I want you to hear the irony in the story. So they had the same language and the same words. It happened as they journeyed east. And it's saying they, as there's no referent, like one particular people group. It's just they. everybody is all journeying east, okay, as a group. They found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there, okay? So they're starting in the west here. They're moving east, kind of back along that line that Abram is coming from, okay? And they're going to find a plain in the valley of Shinar, which is going to be today equated with what would be like southern Iraq, in that particular area. They're moving east, and they find this beautiful valley plain, and they settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth." So they say, we're going to defy what God has said to spread out and cover the earth. Okay, God has said, be fruitful, multiply. There's nothing wrong with city itself. There's something wrong with them saying, we want to all come together. We want to collate together, be a people together. And as Yahweh is going to say in a second, there's nothing that's won't be able to be accomplished by them because they've all come together in order to accomplish something in particular. Okay, so there is a very important idea about after the flood, God saying, I need, or it's going to be the case, that I have to cut things off. I have to limit things in some way. Let's put in capital punishment. Let's change the language. Let's spread people out. Let's increase the time that people are going to have to become more and more and more and more wicked. And then he's saying, in that period of time, Noahic covenant, I'm going to work with Abraham. And I'm going to bring about this line until I get to Messiah, okay, as that increases. But even think about when Messiah comes, when Christ comes, what is the world like? How horrible, wicked, evil is the world in the period of Messiah? Before that, long, long, long before that, Sodom and Gomorrah, right? I have these periods of time where you have Babel, you have a Sodom and Gomorrah where God says, yeah, I promise not to wipe out the entire earth, but Sodom and Gomorrah is so wicked, so evil, that I will completely destroy these two cities. I'm going to completely annihilate these two cities and just get rid of them. Okay? So you have these periods of time, or let's even say the Canaanites. The Canaanites were so wicked, so evil, God said, go into the land and wipe them out. Wipe them out because they're corrupting, polluting the world. So there at Tower of Babel, they're saying, all right, let's all come together. Let's not separate. Let's all come together. Put our malicious minds together, accomplish something, make a name for ourselves so that we have one center. We have one place of the world. People can spread out from there, but everybody knows this is the capital of the world. Okay, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. Now, the most relevant or important aspect of the Tower of Babel is that they're building a tower, but they built a city. It's not only a tower, but they built a city as well. The question is, what's the tower like and what are they trying to accomplish? Some will say that they wanted their tower whose top will reach into heaven. Like they thought in their mind they could build a tower high enough that they could get to God, something like that. That's not quite right. But it's also not entirely wrong. You have at this period, much like the pyramids and the building of the pyramids, you had ziggurats. And a ziggurat, I don't have a picture, I should have brought one, but a ziggurat is it's a stepped structure. Okay, so it's a large step structure. There's one very famous one that Saddam Hussein reconstructed or reworked, refurbished, I guess, in the 1980s. And you can see it's a stepped tower as it goes up. Okay, so it's like just put one giant box and then another box on top of that, another box on top of that until you get to the top. And the top is the temple. Okay, the top is where you interact, where the priest goes or the priests go, and that's where you interact with whatever deity that the ziggurat is built for. So Nana, the moon goddess, had her temple at the top of a ziggurat in Ur of the Chaldeans. Okay, so there is an idea of we're going to reach God. We're going to have some kind of communion. We're going to have some kind of ability to manipulate God, something to that effect. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wouldn't try to push it too far, but I consistently see in different cultures this idea, let's build a structure that's going up as high as it can, not just for the physical sake of visibility, right? They're in a plane of Shinar, so you can look this way, oh, there's the tower, let me go towards it. So there's an aspect of visibility, like here's the center, let's build up something high that's seen, but even more than that is this, let's build it up and let's gain that access, right, to God. So for the sake of manipulation, remember, the theme that we have moving through Genesis is they had perfect communion with God in the garden. The fall happens and God is still there. God's talking to Cain. God is receiving a sacrifice from Abel and Cain. God is there. Enoch walks with God, but as time progresses, like chapter 5, men begin to call upon the name of the Lord, right? Lord, come, bless us, not let me go find where Yahweh is, let me go see where he is and have a conversation with him, but let come and bless us. And now we're building temples in order to try to get to God. There's this major separation, and we're going to see in a second, God says, let us go down. Okay, you see the nuance and the separation. Yes, sir.
Is there some connection like between like the time we live in where grace is available, and then there comes a time when that doesn't be, you know, where we're raptured and then evil just multiplies?
I would very much hold to a pre-tribulation rapture. And this idea that a period is coming in the history of the world such as has never been seen before. So the end is like the beginning. I don't want to push that too far. Okay, I don't want to push it too far unless I see something in the scripture. But I do see prophesied a period to say there is coming a time such as never has been experienced in the history of the world. And that's in reference even to these things, right? It's hard for us to determine or even understand or comprehend what this was like. And there's coming a period of time that will be worse, more evil, more judgment than that even. So I see similarities, but I don't want to push it too far, but I see similarities because that's the nature of man, right? That's man's heart. When you put a bunch of evil people all together, they're either going to kill each other or they're going to do something to harm and destroy other people, right? That's just the nature of empires, if you will. Okay, so Nimrod, remember, Nimrod's controlling this organization of these people. He's an empire builder. So they say, we don't want to be scattered. Let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Let's have a capital city of the world. Okay, it's fairly easy to do at that point. Not so easy to do now. Okay, but at that point, fairly easy to do since they're all together. Then Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. See the irony? They're trying to build a tower to get up to God, and God says, oh, they're back to wickedness. They're back to evil. Let me go down and see what they're doing. God knows exactly what they're doing, but you see how the text describes it. They want to build up. God says, I'll come down to them. Okay? Yahweh said, verse 6, behold, they are one people. They all have the same language, and this is what they have begun to do. So now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. We think of these people as being, living in tents, throwing rocks at each other, that kind of a thing. And I would argue that we have a lot more technology today than they did. But how quickly did we go from shooting muskets at each other, standing in formations, to dropping a nuclear bomb? How quick was that movement of technology? Incredibly quick. Incredibly quick. Okay? And God's saying, how long is it going to take for them? They put their minds to it, they're going to accomplish whatever it is that they want to accomplish, and it's going to be something for evil. So verse 7, come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's language. And this is a really fascinating, it's a fascinating way to solve the problem. I've lived in a lot of different countries over the time, and one, maybe the second or third or so country that I lived in, it just dawned on me. I'm like, if you move to a country in which you do not speak the language there, you're an infant. You're an infant. You're dependent upon someone to guide you. How do I get from this place to this place? I can't do it. In America, here, in the UK, when my wife and I lived there, well, they kind of speak English. you figure out real quick, okay? This is, you got to go to the, you know, their DMV, register a car, do this, do that. I can figure it out. Okay, when I was in, oh, I've lived a lot of different places, Guatemala, a few different places, right? But learning a language, different languages at those places, it takes 6 months, a year, whatever, to learn the language. And when you start learning that language, man, it's like you're 2 years old. How do I get food? How do I get a place to stay? How do I get this? How do I get that? Language is the great separator. Right? The great separator. You can be the most intelligent person. You can be studying a PhD, but if you can't speak the language, you're kind of an idiot. Okay? And they look at you like, what's your problem? Like, go figure it out. Okay? It's the great equalizer. What's fascinating, I'm a nerd and I'm a linguist nerd in particular. So I'm gonna burn up 2 minutes explaining this. There's always been a lingua franca, a main language that's spoken. It doesn't mean everybody speaks it. Certainly doesn't mean everybody speaks it. But you see the transition of languages over time for main languages. The first lingua franca, if you will, the main language, would have been probably Akkadian. Okay, Akkadian as a language. Hebrew's never been a lingua franca. It's never been, you know, a trading language across places. Hebrew's important because the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, but not because it's a expansive language. Okay, so you had Akkadian to begin with. Then you had Aramaic that took the place of that. After Aramaic was Greek. After Greek was Latin. After Latin was what? French. After French, you had English, okay, and Romance languages, right? But then you had English. Today, for the most part, it's English. Doesn't mean the most people speak English. It means that if I want to go to Thailand and conduct business in Thailand, I learn English, okay, just because of the nature of how we're working and conducting business together. Spanish is the language of heaven, okay? Spanish is the language of heaven. It's the next one. It's the next one to come. All right. come, let us go down there and confuse their language. They will not understand one another. Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there Yahweh confused the language of the whole earth. And from there, Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So they separate out and they move out. We can trace back some languages and get like a general category for languages. Okay, we think that at Babel, we're not dividing into 1,000 languages. We're dividing up into, let's say, 7 or 8. Okay, as we trace back languages and see language families. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. 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 Right. Exactly. Yeah. So it's the reason why it's let us go down is because it's a play. It's an irony. It's they want to come up. They want to build up to get to me. The only way for them to get to me is if I come down. And so it's not God absolutely can confuse, he can do anything that he wants, but the idea is let me go down. That's the only way that we're going to get connection. Let me go down, see what they're doing. Oh, they're full of wickedness, so let me create a new way in which to separate them so they're not continuing to act as wickedly as they possibly can. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So for the original language that you spoke, so Akkad is the language of Noah going to the old world?
Yeah. So it's a good question. You're asking a linguistic question. I love that. It's fantastic. Akkadian was like a language of prominence. So you have Egyptian as well, but the Egyptians were fairly insular. So you had people that learned Egyptian, but Akkadian was more of a cross. Like if I want to conduct business in this place, I need to learn Akkadian in order to do that. That's coming about, you know, at the period of, let's say, Abraham. Noah is probably speaking something in terms of what we would call a proto-Semitic language. So it would sound similar to Hebrew, to a Semitic language. And I would argue that in Babel, that language is one of those seven that's left over, right? So if you had eight languages that are created, one of them is the original language which was spoken. So it maintains, I would argue, it maintains its way through. And the reason why I would say that is because you get glimpses of it. Like Adam names his wife Chava, which means Eve. Chava or Chaya from the Hebrew for life, to live. So if he gives her a name that's a Hebrew name or a Semitic name, let's say, it's something like proto-Semitic, even way back in the garden. All right, let me open it up for questions now. Yeah.
So when it said he scattered him abroad.
Yeah. 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 That is a really exact. Does anybody live in Alaska? I don't know if there's anybody there. I'm joking. I have family in Alaska. I lived in Alaska for a while. But they're scattered as far as they go. When it says they scattered them, they're moving. So the scattering is still going on. But what's really fascinating is to study movements of people and even genetics to see who's kind of more related to who. So that's really fascinating. There's all kinds of arguments about, you know, like people moving into Asia and then going up, you know, over through Alaska to come down into the Americas. But right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. It's he caused them to scatter. Might be a better way to translate it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, ma'am.
I've also heard in my reading that Genesis 1-11 is like prehistoric.
Yeah. Yeah.
Abraham can be dated.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think we
can date Abraham. We can figure out, you know, roughly, let's say within 5 years, I would even say, when Abraham is born. But they call it prehistoric, mostly because there's not a huge amount of description that's given. So we have a period of 2,000 years or almost 2,000 years where we're talking about a handful of stories from 2,000 years. And so that's why they're calling it prehistoric, but it's not, sometimes that term is misunderstood or misused. Doesn't have anything to do with them being like prehistoric people or anything like that. It's just a question of how we're dating things. But I would argue from Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, the two genealogies, we can trace back in terms of years and know when's creation, when is the flood, those sorts of things. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So years ago, they had a movie. It was a documentary.
Yeah.
Put out by a bunch of Christians.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you saw it.
I haven't,
So it's really cool. So it talks a lot about things, mainly about the flood and all that stuff, the fossils. But it has this one scene inside there that talks about all the different languages.
Yeah.
All the different outfits and things like that.
Yeah.
And it goes all the way from this big circumference of the circle and keeps going in and in.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And then it ends with this little circle in the middle, and you're not able to identify.
Sure. Yeah.
No, it's a Tower of Babel.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I thought that was so cool.
Right, right.
So fascinating.
Yeah. One of the most helpful things for us in terms of Christians and studying language is the understanding of universal aspects within language. that there are universal things that are in every single language. If language is evolving from different people living in caves or a lot of different places, you are not going to have that in existence. But I can go to any language in the world and I can see universals within that language that will always apply in that language. That's something for, you know, God's putting language in man, not it just randomly evolving in different places, different times. Yeah.
Mythology.
Yeah, right.
So, like, they have the same.
Uh huh, right. And you see, like, glimpses of things that are the same. Right. Like, where is that coming from? Right? Yes, sir.
Yeah, for the language, the Tower of Babel, it's a great equalizer to divide us.
Yeah.
Could you connect now on the Pentecost Day now?
Yes. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Overcoming language, the gift of tongues is the overcoming language in order to spread the gospel. So there's this, let's separate languages to separate people because of their wickedness, but then let's use tongues as a gift to overcome that in order to preach the gospel. Exactly right. There's a whole theology about that. Yeah. Yes, sir.
There's
yeah.
a professor at Masters University named Matthew McLean.
Yeah.
I talked to him a little bit about genetic diversity. Like,
yeah.
You know, in times of Noah and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
About how scientists now are finding, they would say, Neanderthals who are, you know, burying their dead, building boats,
yeah,
doing things like this.
Yeah.
And his answer was that they're humans that are made in the image of God.
Yeah.
But because of time span being, you know, around 6,000 years old, over 6,000 years ago,
sure.
They just look different.
And sure.
Now humans look more similar because of yeah. war. And
right. Yeah, we want to be so careful when we're thinking in terms of let's say, that first 2,000 years, right? What was it like then? What did people look like? What did animals look like? What was technology like? We want to be very careful not to make any assumptions. One of the worst things that we can do is say, this is what the world is like today, and let's just impose that on some other period or some other time. Or it's very, very different. Yeah.
So,
Yeah, I would, yeah. There's question within, like, evolutionary theory about, you know, the movement and of genes and that sort of a thing. I'm not an expert on it, but I've read a few books. So the one caveat that I give to someone who's holding to evolutionary ideas is that there can be a skewing of the data. Right, so I have to first account for what exactly is the true data and then how to explain that true data. So you have to pull apart some of the skewing of the data first and then get to these are the true facts and then how do we account for those facts. Yeah.
So I had a question about, you said Akkadian language. What's the closest thing to that?
What's the closest thing to Akkadian?
So
Akkadian would be like Babylonian. So Assyrian, Babylonian, those that were within the empire.
Somebody like now?
Oh, yeah. What would be similar?
Albanians.
Yeah. Yeah. Leo knows. Have Leo speak, and it's very close. Yeah. It is, honestly. There's Chaldeans today in... you know, all over the place, but northern Iraq, what they speak is probably very related or similar to Aramaic, but they would claim, you know, roots back to Akkadian, that sort of a thing. Yeah. All right, I'm way over time. Questions? I'm happy to take questions up here, but I'll let you go at that. See you next week. Yeah.